Group Meeting, Sunday, 12th February, 1984.
The last 3,500 to 4,000 years have seen the emergence of all the great world religions of today. And with that emergence, in terms of the personal teachings of the great teachers, there has also grown a tremendous religious literature, conventional theology, as well as the writings of the great mystics, and so on. Now, the writings of the mystics tell us a great deal about the change in their own understanding, their outlook upon the fundamental things, God, man, and the universe, so to say. And they have actually developed the teachings of the founders of the religions to a very considerable extent. But their writings are not always easy to understand. What are they talking about? That is something which we must consider. On the other side, we have the writings of the great theologians. And they have presented the conventional orthodox doctrine of the religions of the world. Now, some of the great forces which have played their part in the writings of the mystics, as well as, and particularly I should say, in the writings of the theologians, is the increasing knowledge through the millennia of the nature of things. That is to say, in modern terms, science, mathematics, and so on. That has played a tremendous part in the development and evolution of the theological presentation of reality. Then again, there is the fact that as the centuries pass and new mystics achieve a realization in inward consciousness of the reality of things, they also have helped to produce quite a new outlook. There are many examples of the changes in the theologies of the world due to the advances in the knowledge of the nature of things. Perhaps the outstanding, two of the outstanding examples are with two different theologies which the Catholic Church produced. The Augustinian, which was based on the philosophy of Plato and the ideas of Democritus about the atomic nature of the material world. It was those ideas which introduced the idea that God, or the origin, is the indestructible, eternal, and so on. Then we had, after the Augustinian theology, we had about eight centuries later, the Thomistic theology of St. Thomas Aquinas, who based his theology not upon the writings and the teachings of Plato and Democritus, and of course Jesus Christ, but are upon the philosophy of Aristotle, his psychological and his scientific work. Aristotle probably was the founder, really, of the modern scientific method and the modern scientific procedure, the observation of things and classifying everything. He started that. Now, something has been left out in all these centuries in these writings, both of the theologians and of the mystics. The mystics particularly have used certain words, but they have never clearly expounded their significance and their implications. They have used words like infinity, eternity, and of course everyone has talked about immortality, including the founders of the religions. But what has not been done in any of the writings so far, of course, as far as I am aware myself, and this has been confirmed by friends of mine who are professors of comparative religion in universities, what has never been done by anyone is to indicate how the consciousness of the great spiritual teachers underwent that change which enabled them to realize transcendence. There is another aspect to it. That is in terms of actual experience. But in terms of presenting the consequences as far as the philosophy of religion is concerned, or the different theologies are concerned, is that the understanding of the context of religion and of transcendence as being the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal has never yet been expounded. This is something which we have been trying to consider since 1979, since the autumn of 1979, in our meetings. It is very important to get some sort of understanding, some sort of vision of the significance and implications of the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Because that context is really the context of transcendence itself. And it's a context which does something quite extraordinary. On the one hand, it entirely negates all that we have seen, examined, understood, proved, scientifically proved where the nature of matter and so on is concerned, in our ordinary everyday context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. This is our ordinary everyday context, which means we, as we are at present, are conscious of all existence, of all that happens to us, in terms of finitude, of temporality, and therefore of mortality. And it is because of the influence of that, of this everyday context, that those great teachers in the past, who realized transcendence, who were able not merely to sense, but to function consciously in terms of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal, were unable to expound clearly the significance of the context of the finite, temporal and mortal. And therefore, ideas like rebirth, reincarnation, a hereafter, a life after death, and so forth, and that man is constituted of a body, a psyche, a mind, a soul, a spirit, and all those things came into being. What they couldn't see was that the fundamental fact of all creation and of the creative energy is its unitary wholeness. This unitary wholeness is really the holiness of the divine. That is what it means. They couldn't see that, because functioning ordinarily in terms of the finite and the temporal, it was impossible to produce the concepts and the necessary words to present what they had actually realized in their innermost states. The great contemplatives of the world, as well as the great religious teachers, starting right away from Zarathustra, whose date is now recognized as somewhere near 1400 or 1500 BC. He was earlier than Moses, therefore. He was the first of the great teachers. And all of them have not produced anything in the way of knowledge as regards this context of the transcendence. Well, this context of transcendence negates everything that we discover, believe, and find true, as we say, in the context of the finite and the temporal. It negates that. But note, very carefully, this is the more important part of it. It does not destroy this context. It totally subsumes this ordinary, everyday context. If that were not the case, no such thing as religious insight, as spiritual development, could possibly take place, because there'd be no link if it destroyed this context. It negates it. Negates it in the sense that it shows that it is an inadequate, an imperfect context. And to live by our insights and understandings of life limited to this context is going to mislead us as regards our style of life. And when I say our style of life, I mean our inward spiritual life, which is everlastingly the ultimate truth about ourselves. So now, it doesn't destroy this context. Therefore, we can see one deep significance of that fact. It subsumes it completely, which means that it not merely contains it like a box can contain so many objects or articles, but it completely interpenetrates it. Like space contains the totality of the cosmos, all the galaxies and whatever there exists in the cosmos, space not only contains that, but it interpenetrates that. In fact, I think it wasn't it Einstein who started the idea that matter is the warping of space. Space which is a little bit warped, twisted, constrained, that's the best word I should say. Einstein actually said warping, but I would rather say constrain, you see. Now, the transcendent context, the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, not only subsumes, contains the totality that we experience and can possibly know of in that sense, but it, the whole of transcendence, the whole of infinity, the whole of eternity is completely embodied in every single thing throughout this finite, limited context. Don't ask me how do you know or why do you say that. It just came to me like that, that's all. It is an extraordinary thing altogether. If you ever get that kind of flash, not as the result of having a drink. I mention that particularly because, you know, in both the Zarathustrian and in the Rig Vedic and Upanishadic peoples, in their rituals, they actually made a drink. They took a drink and went into a trance. The soma drink, you see, which the Zarathustrians call the haoma drink, ha, instead of sa. So that's why I mentioned this word drink. I don't mean our modern magical formula, C2H5OH, alcohol, you see, I don't mean that at all. Now, those who were able to enter into that profound state of consciousness realized that that unitary wholeness is never split up in its embodying itself in every separate particular. In the finite temporal and mortal context, everything is separate, of course. We people are separate. Objects are separate, the stars and the planets are separate, the atoms are all separate, and the subatomic particles and so forth, they are all separate, aren't they? Now that separateness is non-existent in the transcendent context. And because the transcendent context wholly interpenetrates, is embodied in the finite, the mortal context, therefore every single thing, every single atom or virus or a human being or any object or anything whatsoever has the whole of transcendence embodied in it. Now one may say, we don't see any evidence of transcendence in a thousand million different people and things in this world. But let us remember, I would say that because I cannot see it. You see, where is the embodied transcendence in the people who commit terrible crimes? Crimes against humanity, genocides and so on, and violence against each other and so on. Where is the transcendence, you will say? It is there. Only the particular individual has cooperated with that power which imprisons the transcendence. How and why does some individual or other, and in fact there are so many such individuals in the world, unfortunately, how and why does that happen? Why does he imprison transcendence and never allow transcendence to manifest? Because he is absolutely captivated. He is the slave of his desires, his animal instincts and passions and so forth. I trust I'm not insulting the animals. The animals live in accord with the laws of their being. It is man alone of the entire animal world who does not, and so many of them cannot, live in accord with the real laws of their being. So such men, such people, crush transcendence very successfully. Now the great teachers were well aware of this, especially in the past. Nowadays we have systems of law, of justice, and organization which can considerably control the behavior of human beings. In those days, in those old days, particularly around about 3,000 years plus or minus 500 years, there wasn't that amount of organization which would control them. Therefore, what happened? The mass of human beings for many, many thousands of years, long before history, the mass of human beings had a belief in spirits. They had a belief in the happy lands after death, and a belief in hell and punishment. So these doctrines of heaven and hell came into being. But they are completely false doctrines. How is it possible for a finite, limited mortal with little capacity after all, you see, to live that he will be awarded an eternal hell or an eternal heaven afterwards? A finite force cannot produce an infinite consequence. But you see, those doctrines had a pragmatic value. It is true that in spite of the threat of hell did not keep a sufficient number of people concerned with living a human life instead of giving full expression to their subhumanity. Not only that, they produce doctrines like a soul and a spirit which embodies you. I'm not denying a real meaning to words like soul or spirit or a divine spark or something. I'm not denying the real meaning of it. But what I do say is this. These people developed the doctrine that whatsoever the living organism, the psychophysical person, does in this life here and now, for whatever he does, it is the soul which after death will be rewarded with a permanent heaven or a permanent hell. And I have read the descriptions of these heavens and hells. You can all read for yourself, for instance, Dante's Inferno. His Purgatorio and his Paradiso. Now, Dante was a peculiar character. On the one hand, he was a profound mystic towards the latter part of his life. And he produced Paradiso, like which there is no other poetical work. It's absolutely the supreme work along those lines. He also produced Inferno, the torments in hell. How did he know? You see, all these are thrown out of the living person's brain. And they are probably, I only suggest probably, the result of repressed fear, hate, anger, and so forth in the writer himself. Now you would say to me, and quite rightly, surely the great teachers, the founders of the religions and the great spiritual teachers and saints, they didn't have that sort of repressed hate and so forth. Probably not. But Zarathustra, for instance, did say that he hated evil and the evildoer. He did say, Ahura Mazda, God, the Supreme Being, hates evil. To hate and punish is totally different from punishing without hating, without malice. You see, if one punishes because one hates and has malice, it is a reaction of evil against a person. But if one has a duty to perform, or let me put it this way, if an individual were to go against the laws of nature, if he will deliberately walk over a cliff, if he will deliberately put his hand into the fire, he will have somewhat unpleasant consequences. So you see, if you look at karma that way, and not at the way in which it has been put in Hinduism, Buddhism, and by St. Paul, whatsoever you sow, that you will reap. It's quite untrue. It may be true up to a very small extent. If I do something, am I the sole agent of that act? What are the influences which have been at play in terms of the prevailing circumstance, in terms of my upbringing, my education, what people have told me, what they have invited me to do, and so forth? What about all those million and one influences which make the chain of which this particular act of mine was the last link? So, was I the only person who sowed? Am I the exclusive agent? Not at all. Not in any case, anywhere, for any thought or feeling, any word or any deed. And therefore, we must see that this person cannot be held responsible for this, that, or the other act in toto. Partly, yes. And it brings an immediate result, usually. You watch your thoughts and your feelings and see how they affect the health of the body and of the mind. It's extraordinary. But you see, the karmic process works out immediately. To say that something is carried over into the future is just a conjecture. And I say it's a false conjecture. The living person here and now is the whole reality, the total reality. When that living person dies, he's dead. In the total sense. That doesn't mean that that which ultimately became this living person is dead. The primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy holds within itself the totality of everything that emerges from it. And that emergent process is where eternity manifests as time. Otherwise, in eternity, there is no good, no bad, no nothing that we can talk about. It's rather difficult to grasp this sort of thing. It is really difficult, but there it is. That primordial creative energy is also absolute consciousness. It is also fundamental substance, immaterial substance. That creative energy, when it gets out of its quiescent state, not static, but quiescent, it's vibrant, it's alive, then consciousness proliferates, the energy concretizes steadily. And with that concretization of that energy, ultimately it ends up as matter as we know it, the solid, liquid and gaseous states. And consciousness has proliferated till in matter, the solid matter, it is most constricted. A stone probably does not know a thing. It's completely constricted. But from that state of solid matter, as the different kingdoms on the planet emerge, the vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, and the human kingdom, consciousness once again begins to awaken to itself. That absolute consciousness at the start, which has been completely constricted, begins to awaken again to itself. This is the great process of our psychophysical as well as our psychomental as well as our spiritual evolution. This emergence and awakening of consciousness. What does it awaken to? It awakens out of its awareness of its existence in terms of separateness and isolativeness into a full cognition, not as a thought, not merely as a thought or an idea, but as an actual consciousness of unitary wholeness. This is one of the purposes of our existence as human beings, that in us and through us this process can take place. It does go on all the time. And when one awakens to that unitary wholeness in terms of infinity, eternity, and immortality, that is the meaning of full enlightenment. That is the light, if you like. It is not the light of knowledge. Knowledge is something which you acquire. That which you acquire dies with you. But this awakening is the immortal reality. So you see, transcendence is completely embodied in each and every one of us, in each and everything in the universe. It is embodied. Don't ask me, why did it happen like that? I don't know. Transcendence hasn't told me. Yet. But that is how it is. So now, what is our particular task here? We have thrown out heaven, we have thrown out hell, we have thrown out a hereafter. You see, the moment you deal with an entity, with something which is separate, that separate something has come into being, has its lifespan, which may be 10 to the power 563 years. 10 to the power 563 years, you see, all right, and then it dies. But this birth-death cycle belongs to the entire context of the finite and the temporal. And it dies completely. That is to say, it dies completely as that particular entity. When when this fellow, John Smith, dies, he'll be completely dead as John Smith. That which became John Smith, starting right from the origin itself, the primordial creative energy, that remains itself because it belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal and the immortal. You see? So that when I die, whether I live as a saint or the most terrible devil on the face of the globe, I will die completely and utterly. But that which became this from out of that primordial state just is in its primordial state. And it is there in totality all the time. So, how should we live? Note one extraordinary fact. What did all the great spiritual teachers teach or try to teach? Be harmless, be truthful, be loving, be decent, and so forth. Understand this organism, which is a manifestation of transcendence. Admittedly, most of these manifestations of transcendence, well, dear old transcendence must be a little bit worried about what it did. But still, they're all evolving. And the way is the way of virtue, essentially. Right in the way back in the Rig Veda, which is the oldest religious document of the human race, not only of the Indo-European peoples, because there was no writing before that. Way back in the Rig Veda, we have this extraordinary teaching of Ritta. Ritta, from which our word right, R-I-G-H-T, as well as our word R-I-T-E, right, is derived. What is Ritta? It is the essential, eternal order of transcendence, which is inherent in every manifestation of transcendence, and which is slowly trying to work itself out, to open out. And it is only in the human kingdom that we can consciously try to cooperate with that wonderful process. How did Zarathustra put it? Because he was contemporaneous with the Rig Veda. The gathas of Zarathustra in the Avestan language, just with a very slight change in the words, is converted into a Vedic stanza. You see? What did Zarathustra call it? Asha. And look at the way Asha, that word Asha, I rather think that word Asha may have been prior to Ritta. Because Asha, Arst, Eres, Eret, and from Eret to Ritta. That's how the words sort of emerged with the people, you see. He called it Asha. And what does Asha essentially mean? Virtue. The divine virtue. But remember that divine virtue is absolute virtue. It is not relative virtue. I will be good and kind to you if. But if not, then I'll be something the opposite. We have to be very careful about these things. Now you see, this divine virtue is an absolute thing. It belongs to the context of transcendence itself. And because it belongs to the context of transcendence, we cannot give definitions in any of our languages. Because my poor brain, which conceptualizes, and my tongue, which speaks out the words, does all this in a very inadequate way in relationship to transcendence. But if, by any chance, it happens to call a harmonious, a sensitive response in your own psyche and in your own mind, then it could be of some help to you. But above all, bear in mind never to follow in the master's footsteps. One of the profoundest errors people have made. Everybody's footprint is different from everybody else's. We are all absolutely unique. Uniqueness does not mean that therefore we are absolutely different in an antagonistic sense, in an irreconcilable sense. We are different in a complementary sense. So you see, there lies the key, if you like, to cooperative activity in living the spiritual life. Otherwise, the formation of a sangha, the formation of a group of people around the great teachers of the past would have no significance or meaning. But it has had significance and meaning, and a tremendous effect upon human history. So you see, be unique, be yourself, by being your not-self. Now this uniqueness is necessary. I mean, to find out your own way, therefore, is absolutely essential. You see, the transcendence itself is not short of originality. Every single thing that it creates is original, is unique. But not unique in the sense of our ideas of different from something else. There is this mystery that the same, the one same thing, becomes the many different things. And that is the glory of God, if you like, as Zarathustra put it, the kvarena. Avestan language is very difficult, it's a real jawbreaker. Kvarena, you see, the glory. And you have it in the Kabbalistic writings. What is the glory?
Ein Sof.
No, not Ein Sof. Fancy. No. It's none of the names of the...
Oh, it's not on the tree.
No, I'll look it up. It's somewhere. You see? So, in all the religions you have this sense of the glory. Of the transcendent, whatever that transcendent means, whether considered as a being, as a personal being, or whether considered as something which transcends all being. In the Rig Veda, in the famous so-called creation hymn, we have it stated in both ways. Then was neither existent nor non-existent. And centuries later, Sri Krishna says, being and non-being am I, O Arjuna. Death am I, and the origin of all things. But you know, the dear theologians and philosophers, caught up in the cobweb of words, have never even touched the reality of the significance of the context of that transcendent, the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And I feel sure that it is along these lines that the new ontologies will come. And modern science is really one of the great helpers in all this.